I think we're all right.
There you go.
Senator Jetz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because of the discussion that we were having in the Commerce Committee last week, we had to do some more work, and we realized that. So I would like to withdraw my amendment that I made during the last committee meeting.
You have to do that?
Yeah, the A4.
We never took
it. Okay, she wants to withdraw the A4 amendment, which is fine. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Amendment 4 is withdrawn. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'd like to offer the A9 amendment, which deals with the civil penalties, which were sections 2 and 3 of the bill.
Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit here. The A9.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The A9 addresses some concerns that providers had in regards to the dollar amount that would be charged in a penalty, and it adds clarification and provides tiers so that everybody, the providers and the Commerce Department, understand and provides some of that clarity. We also added runners and cappers to the same penalty if you are convicted. And the final thing that we added was the ability, if you are convicted of a fraud conviction in the no-fault system, we had originally said that you could no longer participate in the no-fault program. We've added language that there would be a reinstatement process after a period of 5 years. And I do have some people that want to, unless you
want
to
briefly,
I have some that would like to talk to.
Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Goodnow on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. The amendment A9 incorporates the agreement that we've worked out that addressed many of the concerns that the Chiropractic Association has, and with the adoption of this amendment, we would be neutral on those positions, those provisions in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Doug Franzen, representing the National Insurance Crime Bureau. This amendment represents not only negotiations between our organizations and the Insurance Federation, but also is responsive to some of the comments we had heard at last hearing. I'd point out a couple pieces. First and foremost, in terms of the civil penalty, it only applies to intentional acts. So intent is a burden that would have to be established. And I believe Senator Jensen did a terrific job going through the other provisions of the amendment. The one key piece is that it is prospective in nature. There's no retroactive application, and that is on page 2, lines 28-29. So what we really have is something moving into the future so everyone knows the rules of the road. And can act accordingly. We'd like to thank the Minnesota Chiropractic Association and thank the committee. We've had other discussions with some members about other technical provisions that there may, if we're fortunate enough to get to judiciary, I think we might be able to resolve those issues as well. But at this point, I see them as technical in nature. So we would urge your support for the A9 amendment, Mr. Chairman, members.
Discussion, Senator Champion.
To Mr. Franzen, does this amendment still allow for the department to decide if it wants to institute this administrative penalty if a person goes through the criminal proceeding and are potentially found guilty in a criminal context?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, theoretically perhaps, but it's structured so it actually doesn't make sense to do that because you have the intent and the penalties imposed here mirror the criminal penalties in Chapter 609. So what you would have, the penalty has been paid, say if there's a restitution at stake, that has been taken care of. The matter has been dealt with civilly. I kind of wish, Senator, we had a prosecutor here today who would say if this has taken effect and the matter's been resolved in the civil matter, they would rather concentrate on the backlog of other matters they have. But as a strictly technical matter, I don't know. I would say that if the matter has been fully settled criminally, if I were representing the defendant, I would argue that any penalty civilly would be arbitrary and capricious and therefore non-enforceable.
Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But usually the criminal issue comes up first, right? And so usually if a person is found guilty, then restitution would be appropriate. But my only concern, it sounds like, and perhaps this can still be clarified, is that even if a person goes through the process and is found guilty, that the Department of Commerce still has the ability to say, notwithstanding this finding of guilt and notwithstanding the fact that this person is in the criminal proceeding, we can opt to do it outside of that criminal context.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, I do know the answer to that. If there has been a criminal conviction and restitution has been ordered and paid, there is simply no basis for restitution on a civil level because the restitution has been paid. The victims have been made whole. So there is no basis for restitution. And to charge that in a civil case would, again, be arbitrary and capricious. Likewise, if restitution has been fully paid in a civil fine, the Department of Commerce, I can't think of a reason why in the world a prosecutor could think they could convince a jury to, in effect, double the restitution, because in the civil process, the victims of the fraud have been made whole. And technically, that is the piece, Mr. Chairman, Senator, we want to be clarify, and frankly, I don't have the technical language, but as I play out the various scenarios, I cannot imagine one, I can't think of one in which someone, regardless of which process would occur first, where you'd have a double fines or double jeopardy. Now, what you could have is someone civilly fined and then criminally convicted. And with the criminal conviction, there is a penalty that includes incarceration. But that would be up to the discretion of the court.
Last comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Wait a second. Senator Jetson, did you have a follow-up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that that's certainly not the intent of what we're trying to do here. And if there is language, and I'd be very willing to work with the senator to try to see if there is some language to provide that. And the next stop is judiciary. I know you want to work on this and get it in the shape it is, but I would like to work with the senator and make sure that his concern is addressed in this, because that is not the intention to do both. So with that.
Champion, is that some kind of assurance that
yes,
you can take a look at it? Well, we're going to probably move it out of here, and we could try to work on that as we go forward. Normally, we like to do our work, all of our work here, but on this one, we're going to. Senator Goodwin, did you have a?
I did. This still, though, allows for a preponderance of the evidence versus clear and convincing evidence. I'd like to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin. The burden of proof is the same for every state agency that finds everyone, which is it's really preponderance of the evidence, and that comes about because anything less than that is actually arbitrary and capricious and not enforceable. So yes, you are correct. Under this civil penalty, as with all civil penalties, it is preponderance of the evidence. Where we differ from the others is we have added the additional burden of establishing intent, which is not true if, say, the Commerce Department is going after an insurance company. They can put an insurance company out of business without this. So that if there is any difference between the burden in this bill and basically the rest of administrative law, it's that this is a higher burden. It's a higher burden on the Commerce Department because of the intentional requirement.
Okay. Is that clear to you? Just kidding.
It is clear to me. I still think that there's a big difference, though, between administrative penalties from other agencies and administrative penalties for the insurance industry because, as I said before, this is the only industry that the state protects, not only protects, but also requires everybody to have insurance and then keeps passing this legislation to make the insurance companies more comfortable. At the same time, we have very difficult time in the legislature all the time I've been here passing any legislation that assists the consumer. But we certainly can pretty easily make these things happen for the insurance industry. That's my complaint.
Okay. Any further discussion on the A9 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill as amended. I understand it has two more stops.
It does, Mr. Chair, and I do have one more amendment.
Okay. What's... Oh.
The A11 amendment.
Thank you. It's not in.
This one deals with Section 1 and removes Section 4.
A11?
Here it is.
I think you could start explaining.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of work that's been done on insurance fraud in all states because of the growing situations that are coming up. What we're trying to do and have tried for the last 2 years to get a handle on is that accident report information in Minnesota is public information. And we were trying to address the availability of people basically having a list of victims available to them that we create. So in order to address this, we thought we could do a 30-day wait period in the data privacy section. Because of the work that's been done, I understand that that's no longer possible. So we're going to take a different look at this and a different approach that other states have been doing. Michigan just passed a law that says you cannot utilize the accident report information for marketing or solicitation purposes. Kentucky is looking at this year putting that into their laws as well. And there are at least four other states that have had that in their books for a number of years that, yes, you can get the information. If you go to get it, you can look at it, but you can't use that information as a marketing or a way to reach those people directly. So that's really getting to the accident victim solicitation piece, which is what we've been trying to address, like I said, for the past 2 years in the working group, in the task force recommendations, and now moving forward with this amendment this year, would say that you cannot directly solicit or offer to provide a commercial service based on the information that you receive off of an accident report. And if some others would like to testify to that, that's fine.
Johnson, would you like to say a few words?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just very briefly, after the last hearing and a meeting with Senator Jensen, I've had discussions recent days to try to refocus instead of limiting the access to the data. So as Senator Jensen described, this takes that away, so we're not limiting anybody's access. In fact, we're not dealing with the accident report information at all. And instead, looking at, as Senator Jensen indicated, some other states that have looked at this solicitation issue, and really this is the A11 amendment. I did have meetings, and I'm not speaking for, but I don't know if he's here today. Mark Anfinson, the Minnesota Newspaper Association, who I know in prior sessions was very interested in this issue of accessing. And I think I can say that with this amendment that Mr. Anfinson and the Newspaper Association is neutral on this. So they don't have a position against it because we're not affecting anybody's access. So I believe and support this amendment as a targeted approach kind of activity without trying to get into the data privacy issues and affecting that, because that brings to the table a whole other raft of issues. So this looks a lot like Michigan's law that went into effect in the past year, and Senator Jensen mentioned the other states. So we think it targets the activity, takes it without dealing with the privacy issues and the accessing of records and the names. We're not trying to affect anybody's communication, advertising. There's no effect on that. It is truly a targeted effort at dealing with that direct solicitation as Senator Jensen described. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I support this amendment and believe this is a better approach and a more focused approach than as we've been trying to
further
do.
Further discussion on the 11th Amendment. Senator Latz, and we have a witness, I believe, too. Would like to? Would you like to?
I'd like to hear the witness first.
Welcome, Mr. Carlson, to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I've just had a chance to peruse the amendment and hadn't seen it before the page came and brought it to us. I do have some concerns about the language in my initial review of it, Mr. Chairman and members, and one of those concerns is that it doesn't preclude or it doesn't specifically state what during this period of 30 days an insurance company can do with an insured. Can they settle their case? Can they dispose of their case without the benefit or opportunity of having advice either from a medical provider or counsel? I don't see how that is covered in here, and that would give us some concern. The other thing that you have to know in the everyday practice of our lives is that you'd run into people who — I was in a car accident this morning on the way to work, and you should call someone, or this guy handled my case, and you should talk to them. It seems to me that in that scenario, the way this is written, you could be convicted of a gross misdemeanor for having any contact with a client or potential client during the 30-day period following an accident. And while I don't necessarily believe that is the intent, if I make any contact with a family member or an individual and I offer to provide legal services to them for 30 days following a motor vehicle accident, as I read this language, it would seem to me that that I may be guilty of a gross misdemeanor. And while I don't know that that's the intent, that certainly is, I think, at a minimum, an unintended consequence of this particular language. So what does the insurance company do during those 30 days when you can't get information or advice? And what happens when you just, through your existing list of clients or family members or people that you know, have someone want information, which may be viewed as a direct solicitation that gives rise to liability on behalf of counsel providing that advice? So those would be my comments, Mr. Chairman, and happy to try and answer questions.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely, that's not the intent. In fact, we've listed in here and made it that if the person contacts them, that that would not be considered part of this portion of the bill. Plus, we've distinctly identified in the definition that it means a written solicitation or offer. So with a written solicitation or offer is what we're talking about in this particular amendment, so that whatever, if somebody happens to run into somebody and know that would not be included. Just if you get the information off a report, you have the information, if you are going to solicit and put information out in writing in a solicitation or offer, you have to wait for 30 days. You can do whatever you want to after 30 days, but for that 30 days, there's a waiting period that you're not going to go and solicit them through a written solicitation or offer, either electronically or through other methods like that, but it does not include verbal. So with that, this is an important piece of what we're trying to do. We're not trying to eliminate all fraud. We can't do that with legislation. But what we can do is put into place, the way I look at this and the reason I've supported this all along, is we're creating a list of victims, really. seriously, that we make open to the public. And there are good people that are working to help these people be made whole, whether it's an attorney or a chiropractor or a provider or an insurance agency or an insurance company. All of those players have to be in place in order for the person that's been involved in an accident to recover and be made well. But there are also those that are using the system and that information to fraudulently manipulate the system and getting money and making a living utilizing that information. So this is an attempt to say, no, we're not going to allow the use of solicitation with that accident data. It'll still remain public, but we would like a 30-day waiting period to take place.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, I won't prolong this, but one of the concerns that we have as it relates to getting information from counsel is that it really isn't related to fraud. The amendment that you adopted, the A9 amendment, specifically speaks to those that are engaged in fraudulent conduct. Simply getting a letter in the mail from a provider or from counsel that you have rights is not fraud. It is under the lawyer's professional rules of responsibility. It has to be noted as advertising. It has guidelines that it has to follow. And you are saying now with this amendment that you cannot give consumers information about their legal rights after they've been involved in an accident. And that's where we think if it's not related to fraud, you're simply restricting consumers from getting information in a way that can be valuable to them. And in some instances, it goes in the waste paper basket, and that's fine. I'm not here promoting flooding anyone's mailbox with unsolicited information. But there are instances where it is of value, and I think this takes us away, and it's not, in our opinion, directly related to combating fraud. That's our overarching concern. We've had it for several years, and Senator Jensen is well aware of it. So that is our concern.
Senator Jensen, did you have a Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I was a fraudster and looking for people that have been in accidents, this is a place to go to find it. So that's the portion that is fraud.
Fraudster.
And it's not an act of fraud, but it's promoting if they have that availability, and we make it easier for them to find those victims.
Senator Fischbeck.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Senator Jensen or someone, if there's anyone who – there's a lot of talk about fraud, and I'm wondering what the statistics or the proof that we're actually getting at it with this legislation. I mean, are there a lot of convictions or fraudulent cases that are going on with these solicitations? I guess if there was some kind of proof that you could put your arms around, I would better understand the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach. When we had the working group and took a look at this, actually the first task force that Representative Abler talked about, runners and cappers are people that do this. They go and look up information from reports that are public information and then go contact the people individually. We're not even addressing that here because they can still verbally contact their victim. But what's happening in no-fault states, and this does go to no-fault, and that's why Michigan has enacted commercial solicitation, and Kentucky is taking a look at it too, is because of that availability of that information of who. It's a targeted way for people that are doing this. And I can't tell you specifically, but we had numbers in regards to how this impacts. The other way that it's done is if you're a provider, some people have been convicted of you get the name and the information and you charge the insurance company and never even do anything. But because you have the information and that they have been in an accident and they can use the accident report, so they are getting paid fraudulently because they never even provided the service. So this would remove some of that. That's what we're trying to get to. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of discussion last week. We have four or five more bills to go, but that doesn't mean we don't want to be thorough. But
I'm not sure.
I'd be happy to share more examples with Senator Fischbach.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jensen, one question that hasn't been answered is the one that was raised by Mr. Carlson as his first point, which is what restrictions, if any, are there on the insurance company from trying to settle the case out quickly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Latz. With this amendment, that really doesn't that would be handled in other areas of law that they are already under scrutiny, that it isn't impacted within this legislation. There are statutes out there that's why the Insurance Fraud Bureau is there, too, to do the investigation on the insurance companies and the insurance agents. Those things already exist, but not within this bill and not within this amendment. And I am very open and willing to take a look at that. And if that is something that we need to take a look at in the task force or otherwise, the working group is still there. I'm not sure. I can't remember if that was in particular addressed during the working group. But I am very interested in making sure that if there are issues in that we take a look at that and put it in another bill. But I do not think that it fits within this scope of this amendment in this particular bill.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard of, and I'm sure others have heard of, cases where the insurance company gets this list or they find out from their own insured there's been an injury, and they move in, they swoop in promptly and forcefully to try to take advantage of the fact that someone may not have yet obtained a lawyer or an advocate on their behalf, may not yet have had a full medical workup, and may feel under pressure to get some cash in quickly to deal with their new circumstances, and to settle the claim, this potential claim, very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's fraud of a different kind, but although technically it isn't really fraud. It might not be a misrepresentation involved in there, mm-hmm. or any lying or cheating going on, but it's certainly an imbalanced power relationship mm-hmm. in that situation. But I don't know that it would rise to any, anything the Fraud Bureau would investigate. Mm-hmm. One of the advantages of allowing, frankly, lawyer and chiropractor solicitation by mail is it puts very quickly in the hands of consumers in their mailbox some telephone numbers that they can pick up the phone and call and say, hey, I may need something here. They don't have to wait until they drive by a billboard or until they happen to see, if they're home during the day, happen to see an ad on television with a phone number to call or any of the emails that may come out. I'm not even sure email addresses are in this accident report, so you're not going to be having the electronic solicitation that we all allow and see every day in our email inboxes. But this doesn't do anything to deal with the flip side of the equation. And it seems to me that there's a reason why, to the extent that we have a free market, that we have a free market that allows all parties to the market to participate in that market. And that would mean lawyer solicitation? Sure it would. Because lawyers are businesses just like all sorts of other businesses are out there. And they have a right under our free market economy, subject to certain other restrictions, of course. But when they have potential customers, to go out and let those potential customers know. I get door hangers at my door from companies that want to paint my house or replace my gutters. I get stuff in the mail every day from furnace companies that want to replace my furnace, even when I don't need my furnace replaced. And so I just look at it, and I call them if I want to, or I toss it in the garbage if I want to. Here you're dealing with much more substantial issues than replacing a furnace. Yet there's proposed a restriction on commercial, legitimate, authorized, lawful commercial activity, which would have the effect of restricting consumer information and consumer choice at a time when I would argue it's most needed. And so it seems to me this is an anti-free market overreach to try to protect against not only fraud but have the effect are going way, way beyond that. If there are a way to target only fraudulent communications, I'd be all for that. But I don't see how this amendment certainly doesn't do that. And it creates a gross misdemeanor crime to accomplish that end.
Senator Kosaka, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Latz's point, I don't think this was on the record before, but in statute we say that they have to respond within 10 days, the insurance company. So
they better be swooping within that first 10 days or they get under fire from us. So that's part of the reason that process is there. And what we're trying to deal with is the inaccurate data that when we looked in the working group, we looked at a lot of the material that was being sent out, and a lot of times the data just flat out was not accurate. The promises were much more than what personally injured protection pays. And so that was our concern there. I hadn't seen this amendment till today, but we still are allowing them to get the data, and we still are allowing them to make a call or see them in person. So it's not like this is a large step back from where we were, I think, trying to recognize some of your concerns.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Lantz wants to respond.
Okay.
I would just say I'd be happy to work with you on a bill that targeted inaccurate lawyer advertising, if you will. If they're making representations that are not lawful, that are not accurate in terms of what's available to a consumer who's been injured in an accident, I'd be the first one to sign on to a bill with you to target that kind of illegal advertising. That, to me, would be completely inappropriate solicitation. But this bill doesn't do that.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, and I'd be very willing to work on something like that with you too, Senator Lantz. And the thing that's different about this than some of the examples that you gave is when you send out consumer information, it's different. You use different marketing other than public police records to gain that information. So this is a way to because it's targeted and you know that those victims are victims of an accident by pure nature of that's the list, we're trying to prevent that. And we're not trying to say that attorney can't send out the solicitation to anybody they want to if they get it in a way that's not received off from a public record based on a particular incident that you had and as far as an accident goes.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that, Senator Jensen, you were trying to definitely make a change from your current bill, but yet again, it still does something that no other industry that I know of gets to do, and that's withhold information from people that could use it to actually help the consumer. So if it's in written means or mail or email or regular mail, you're just saying that then they can call them and talk to them and convince them to use their services, but they just can't do it with a letter or an email where it's really easy to throw those away, but it's harder to somebody to. It's easier for somebody to convince you on the phone even that you need their services for whatever reasons. So it just doesn't make sense any way you look at it. Because I definitely agree with Senator Lantz in saying that this prevents them from getting information, and that is not fair. And if it's 10 days that the insurance company has under current statute to respond. That doesn't prohibit them from resolving the claim in 10 days, and that makes it even worse because people can't get the information for 30 days, but the insurance company can make an offer to resolve the case in 10 days. So it's not good in the bill, and it's not good in the amendment, in my opinion.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Jensen.
We haven't removed access to the public information. Everybody can still get the information. They just can't do a solicitation through mail.
Senator Fischbeck.
Mr. Chair.
Senator, before that, Senator Pratt, I think he had his hand up there for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to have to take off here in just a minute. Two things. First of all, we already limit solicitation based on data. If you look at the Fair Credit Reporting Act, you can't utilize credit data to send out solicitations without a lot of rules and regulations around it, but just general solicitation is prohibited. So this isn't new. We, it's been done in other areas. And if I'm not here to, I hope Senator Jensen will offer the A5 amendment, which will add some consumer protection to require insurance companies to disclose to an insured their rights to representation if they do try to settle within 30 days.
Okay.
One last point to that.
Good one.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. Senator Pratt's point, people can't use credit data to solicit, but the insurance industry can use credit data to base your rates on. Another unfair situation. So.
Mr. Chairman, briefly.
Carlson, briefly, and we're gonna move on here.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, not to prolong this, but you need to know that I can't find on this amendment anywhere that obtaining the information is at all related to a public record. It just says on line 1.16 and 1.17 that an individual knows that they've been involved in a motor vehicle accident. It is not related to obtaining that information from a public record. And just briefly, Senator Fischbach's question, I'm unaware of any convictions for counsel anyway for fraudulently advertising. Those complaints are looked at aggressively by the lawyers board, and I'm not saying one hasn't happened, but certainly nothing that jumps out at me that I've seen.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that actually is a good catch. I don't see it on here either, but that's supposed to be on there. So I ask your indulgence to put this on. Let's pass it to Judiciary and make sure that we get that then in the Judiciary Committee with that understanding that that's what this is supposed to do. There's been a lot of work that's gone in. We've come way back. We understood through conversations that we needed to make these changes. I'm asking for support on this amendment to put it on with the understanding that I will work with Senator Champion and I will work with Carlson to make sure that those concerns are addressed.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Jensen, might I make a suggestion that we just, I know that the last time you were here, whatever it was, last Wednesday, you had actually offered to just remove Section 1. Mm-hmm. And I would be much more comfortable if we just withdrew the A11 and removed Section 1 and sent it on to Judiciary, because I don't sit on Judiciary, so I won't have that opportunity to look at what new language until it comes to the floor. But I think since you've already, you know, you've said that you're going to be working with Senator Latz and Mr. Carlson to create something that's workable, I guess that would be my suggestion if you would just withdraw the A11 and remove Section 1, which you offered the last time we were here, and then just move it on to Judiciary.
Thank you, Senator Fischbach. Mr. Chair.
Jensen.
The two things that I'm talking about are a connection. It's not changing it substantially. It's to make sure that we get some technical changes in two areas. So I think we should take a vote to put the amendment on and then pass the bill to Judiciary.
Mr. Chair.
Further discussion. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, I know that there's a lot of folks who have been talking to me about this, and I'm just not comfortable with this amendment, nor with Section 1. And I think you did it. Sections 2 and 3, I can accept and vote for, but I'm just really uncomfortable with this part of it. I don't think we have all of the bugs worked out of it yet, and I don't think that it really gets at what you're trying to get at. And so I guess I would just respectfully ask you to do that if, because like I said, lots of people have been talking to me about it.
Yeah. Like, Senator Kosalka, did you have any, Senator Latz, did you, the last word? I think we're going to, the author wants to continue on and take the vote on A11. Further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails. Is there another amendment that you have? No. Jensen, what's the oh, nothing?
She has.
I do. I have an amendment.
Oh, Senator Goodwin. Okay.
It's not in the packet, though.
That the A5?
I don't know what number it is.
Perhaps. Can you describe it?
It's the abuse prevention.
Oh, forget about that. Where is that?
I can start describing.
Yeah, you can start explaining it. Is this okay?
It's a no-fault whistleblower amendment, And the different sections allow for, one allows for addressing abuses by multiple stakeholders. It's a way to begin addressing abuses by not just health care providers. Includes attorneys, insurance payers, service providers, and injured persons. And the whistleblower provision, like several other states, creates a whistleblower statute based on established federal and state provisions for helping to prevent abuses. And then goes on to it's establish a private cause of action for abuses by the insurance companies. And then it, Section 3 amends Subdivision 2B to make it clear that any stakeholder can file a complaint with the Commerce Fraud Bureau, not just the insurance companies. And then it amends Subdivision 8 to make clear that the Commerce Fraud Bureau can consult with any relevant professional or commercial licensing board in the course of an investigation. Basically, that's the amendment.
Well, there's a Senator Goodwin. Have you introduced this as a separate bill at all, or no?
I just put it in today.
Yeah, just personal opinion. There seems to be so much going on here, and we do have 6-7 bills, and a senator's entitled to offer obviously amendments. But you know, a 2-page kind of a bill that I think. Well, anyway, Senator, I just think that this is worthy of a...
Mr. Chair?
Kind of a full-blown discussion rather than...
And this did come up in the working group and some of the working group things that we did, but I'm very willing to, as far as the work that I've done on the working group and maybe in the task force, we could have a good conversation about this in totality and... I support the effort. I just don't know if it's good to be in this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Give assurance that you would look into this and absolutely. Kind of give it an honest, full discussion? And
absolutely.
I just, for what, just think it's too much to handle it in this meeting, Senator.
I understand, and I agree, so I will withdraw.
Yeah, I would appreciate that.
Got a lot of information. We could maybe discuss it in judiciary and go from there.
Senator Jetson, did you have a...
Well, I am interested in the A5 amendment as well, if that's something that we could put on.
That was Pratt's.
Did you have an A5 amendment, did you say?
I think there is an A5 amendment.
Pratt's amendment.
It's Senator Pratt's.
Oh, is that Senator Pratt? Did he visit with you about it? What does it do? Tell us the committee.
Well, it requires notification from the insurance companies before they settle a claim that they have the right to an attorney.
Oh, it is, yes.
That they have a right to attorney.
Yes.
Yes.
What?
Good.
Is this a good idea, Senator Jetson?
I think so.
Anybody in the audience opposes this A5?
I haven't seen the A5, Mr. Chair.
This is going to be...
Johnson, did you have a quick comment? Or Mr. Carlson or whoever? Senator Ryan?
Mr. Chair, committee member Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation. I have visited with Senator Pratt about this. I haven't committed to it, but I've committed to him that conceptually in what he's trying to address in terms of this information and what the consumers have is an issue that we can work with him and you on. So I met with him, visited. He showed me the language. He did have it available for the last full committee hearing and didn't offer it. So I think this is an issue that we can continue to work with Senator Jensen and Senator Pratt and the others on.
Senator Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, unlike the last amendment, which I appreciate Senator Goodwin withdrawing, I like the content but couldn't digest it. So hopefully it will come up again at the next stop. We have had, I think, a good deal of discussion on this point, so I know I'm supportive.
Okay. Senator Latz on A5.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little bit torn because normally I would I would support this kind of disclosure, although I'd want to have some kind of a separately initialed acknowledgement by the claimant that they received the notice and understood it, not just it. You know, be a part of a 15-page document. But I've had prepared a separate amendment that would simply prohibit an insurer from settling a claim within 60 days unless the claimant is represented by counsel. And I think that would restore some of the balance to the bill that's moving forward. So I'm fine with the idea of, you know, of giving notice, but I'm not sure that it accomplishes enough. I'm not sure how to blend the two. I'm not sure I could blend the two on the run here either.
But so we're gonna blend the A5 amendment into the.
Maybe what I'll do is if the author of the amendment would include provisions that require separately initialed acknowledgement that they're waiving their right to have a counsel represent them, I'd support the A5 amendment, but then I tend to offer the A12 amendment after that as well and figure out how it all blends at some other time, I guess.
Take it as is.
All right, Jetson. I thought I was pretty good at getting out of binds, but I okay, we're on the A5 amendment. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Now, do you want to try something else?
Well, okay, I guess my request for additional language in the A5 amendment was completely ignored.
It wasn't completely ignored. I thought you said something about you had the A12 that come later.
No, unless I missed some response. Well,
we're not going to get too picky here. We're a very friendly committee, so what do you want to do now, Senator Letts?
All right, I'd like to offer the A12 amendment.
That's what I thought I heard. Okay.
I have an oral addition to the A5 amendment, Mr. Chairman, when you're ready. A12 amendment, when you're ready.
Why don't you state your oral amendment to get the...
At the end of line 5, before the period, insert, unless the claimant is represented by counsel.
I'd like to have the pastor there, too.
Okay, we're going to insert that amendment. All right. Further discussion on the
Mr. Chair?
A12 amendment. Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, the National Insurance Fraud Bureau would oppose this amendment. It conflicts with existing Minnesota law. You'd have to go back to unfair claims practices, I believe it's 72A, which actually works for prompt settlement of claims. Let me give you one example. On Friday, a rock hit my windshield. On Saturday, I called my insurance agent. On Saturday, my windshield was fixed. I was very happy with it. I'm driving the car very safely today on Monday. That situation would be illegal under the amendment. Also, there are various coverages in no fault, bodily personal injury or PIP, first party protection, third party claims, property damage. This makes no distinction between any of them. But probably most importantly is if I am in a traffic accident and I choose to, set, as a consumer and an insured, choose to settle my claim promptly and be done with that, I lose that right. So we would characterize this as an anti-consumer amendment, and we would urge that the committee not support it.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
Then I would, in response to that, and I appreciate the comment, I would add an additional oral amendment on line 4. After the word settle, delete a and insert an injury. So it only apply to injury claims. But I think we'll note the disparity here. On the one hand, we are proposing to deny the accident injury consumer information that might arrive in mail based on otherwise public accident data. get here. The effort is to protect that consumer by allowing them to settle claims promptly, perhaps under intense pressure from an insurance company that might even come in and say, you know, settle now and we'll give you $20,000. If you settle later, you know, after you got a lawyer, it's going to be a lot tougher. It's going to drag it out forever. Lawyer's going to take a third of the settlement amount. So the consumer, I don't see where the protections are here for that consumer.
Mr. Chair.
Jansen, did you have a...
Sure. Senator Latz, there are distinct differences in the two scenarios. In the first scenario, you don't have a contract. You're not having a relationship with the person. It's random. In the second scenario, when you're settling a claim, it's because you have a right to settle the claim based on a contractual basis, having that relationship with that person. And in order to honor your contract, you have to settle the claim. That's the responsibility that you sign up for when you as a consumer sign up with an insurance company and the insurance company's responsibility to you with that contract. So that is a different relationship than what we're talking about earlier. What we're talking about earlier is for somebody to randomly look up your public information that is public but using it for solicitation, where what we're talking about here and what you're talking about is the responsibility and the duty of the insurance company to fulfill a contractual obligation with their policyholder where they already have that contractual relationship. So that's why I have some issues with this, but I understand the concept that there are some issues with claim settlements with insurance companies, and that is why we took a look at it in the task force, in the working group on insurance fraud. We weren't able to directly reach that. But if we ever get to the next bill, Mr. Chair, that one is set up to look at some of these other issues. We're not trying to solve every issue in this particular bill. We're trying to address things that have worked in other states, that other states are doing, that is combating some of the fraudulent behavior that people are participating in. I understand your point, and I take it very seriously, and I've done that working group process, including everyone at the table, and anybody that you talk to can say that process was there, and we're moving to the next step to make a task force to look at this no-fault situation, including insurance companies, including agents, including consumers, including practitioners, everybody, to come to the table to see if we can find some conclusion and to fix those things. And if claims is an issue, I will take a look at it, and I do make that commitment, but it's not what this bill is trying to do. This bill is addressing three things. How are people finding their victims? How are we finding them if they fraudulently act in a fraudulent manner? And then should they be able to participate in a program if they do so? That's all this bill is addressing. So I would ask that we not adopt this amendment now, but pass the bill onto judiciary where we can deal with those three things in particular. How are fraudsters finding their victim? How are they getting penalized? How are we deterring them from behaving in that manner? And then if you do get convicted of that fraud, don't participate in the no-fault program, because that is what is driving this increase in Minnesota, is that no-fault program. And then move on to the next bill where we can take a look at that task force and address some of the other issues that we're talking about today, Mr. Chair.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, Senator Latz, I respect where you're coming from, but there are unintended consequences to this particular amendment on the fly, one of which is you're delaying payments to ambulance, emergency rooms, and EMTs for at least 60 days. You're delaying payment to first responders, which I don't think any of us wants to do. It has the unintended consequences. The insurance company holds on to the money. Whereas if I'm injured in a slip and fall and I'm carried to a hospital in an ambulance, treated in the emergency room, it's electronically billed to my health insurer, which my health insurer is Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is an amazingly good health insurer, by the way. They pay it electronically within a week. Now, that put the effect of your... But if your amendment were to pass in that same situation, if I were hurt in a traffic accident rather than a slip and fall in front of my house, there'd be a minimum of 60-day hold on the payment.
It's not the case.
Before you can settle that claim. Now, you could go ahead and pay bills without settling the claim if you want to, but it's certainly a disincentive to prompt settlement with first responders.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick response on that point. This says settle. You can't settle the claim. Not that you can't pay bills that are obviously otherwise obligated to pay.
Okay. Senator Lass, did you add a word or two again to this? I think you did. Did we get the? Did, I think you amended it verbally again.
I did, yeah.
You know that couple words you added? Did you get that, Counselor?
I think I got it.
Maybe we have it already.
Mr. Chairman? Here. I'm going to withdraw the A-12 amendment.
Okay, we're on the bill as amended. Further discussion? See, not all those in favor signify by... And the bill is to be forwarded to the...
As amended to judiciary.
As amended to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Jensen, did you have your next one? You ready?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The next file is...
I was just thinking, you have to sit here anyway. Senator Laurie, are you... kind of ready to go? Yeah, why not? Would that be all right, Senator Jensen?
Yeah, because... Yeah, Laurie's not even on the agenda.
Yes.
Senator...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1113.
On working on Senate File 1113, Senator Laurie. Health insurer, third-party payer payments, time frame, and information requirements, Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what this is, Mr. Chair and members, is the portions of the governor's HHS budget bill that have ramifications for the Commerce Committee here before you today. I have an author's amendment, an A2 amendment, that is a couple of additional items that were flagged in the governor's budget. If I could get those moved, and then I can discuss those as well. Just
that, Chair, the A2 amendment.
It is the A2.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Senator Reinhart will move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the... Okay. On the A2 Reinhart amendment, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So then on the bill, sections 1 and 2, as you mentioned, strengthen the administration's ability to collect on third-party liabilities. As you may know, Medicaid and our public programs are considered the payer of last resort, and where there are other insurers involved, the private insurance is intended to pay first, and then our public programs pay last, Medicaid pays last. And sometimes Medicaid winds up paying when there are third-party liabilities, and those are outstanding. And what this provision does is it enhances the administration's ability to make sure that they can collect. So Section 1 requires a health insurer to process a claim from a state agency for covered expenses paid under the medical programs within 90 business days, and authorizes the state agency to grant the health insurer an additional 30 days to process the claim if the request is submitted within 30 business days after the insurer received the claim. And it authorizes a health insurer to request a refund of the claim paid in error to DHS within 2 years of the date the payment was made, and states that a request for a refund received after this time period will not be honored. Section 2 requires an employer or third-party payer to provide DHS within 60 days of a request the following information as part of the data file: name, date of birth, SSN, employer status, policy identification number, group identification number, and plan or coverage type. That's the third-party liability sections. And then what we added in the A2 amendment are a couple of long-term care provisions. The first is establishing long-term care call center, kind of expanding the role of our senior linkage line. And the Section 4, then, again in the A2 amendment, is actually the title says it's development of a long-term care life stage planning insurance product. It's actually the Commissioner of Human Services in consultation with the members of the Own Your Own Future Advisory Council looking at the feasibility of a life stage planning insurance product, and what that is envisioned as is, you know, the insurance needs of an individual change as they age. So early on in life with, you know, marriage and kids, life insurance is very important. But then as we age and the kids grow up and move out, and our insurance needs kind of transition into maybe the need to look at long-term care insurance products. And so this is looking at the feasibility of designing a product that would change with individuals changing insurance needs as they age. So this is something that was brought forward with the governor's budget, and those are the extent of the commerce items. I would stand for questions. I think that the
agenda. Rory, do you know of any opposition to this going forward?
Mr. Chair, the health plans have some concerns with the third-party liability aspects of the bill, but they are in conversations with the Department of Human Services. They're in the hall today working through things, and we're listening to their concerns and seeing what we need to do.
Do you wish to briefly
talk to the committee? Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to make some comment. Just want to put it on the record that we're continuing to look at this language and meet with the folks from the Department of Human Services to understand exactly how this would work to make sure that it doesn't harm anybody's ability to be able to access these third-party liability payments on behalf of DHS or the health plans. So I just wanted to get it on the record that we're continuing to work on this. Thank you.
Health and Human Services. This could be at the end of the day in the larger bill, maybe the Health and Human Services or not,
Mr. Chair. So
I don't know.
Well, what this is, you know, the governor's HHS proposal is a very large bill, and so what we've done is
breaking it up.
Committees that have jurisdiction over a couple of pieces of it, we split those off into separate bills so that we don't have to take that big monster through all of the policy division. So whatever amendments are made here, we would incorporate into the larger governor's budget bill, and it would be in the HHS omnibus budget bill, you know, to the extent that it's acted upon favorably. Yes.
Did we have do you have a couple of witnesses from the department?
Mr. Chair, they were available for questions. They weren't necessary to provide testimony unless the
Senator Deems.
Mr. Chair, it's not a question, just to the senator, it's a question: what's the next step that this bill will go to? Where does it go from here?
So,
finance,
Mr. Okay. Chair, Senator Dames, yes, this would go to finance. The rest of the governor's budget has made it to finance with these provisions in it, but we split those out again. And whatever, you know, if any amendments are adopted here, those would be incorporated into the larger bill as we get to finance. So, yes, this would go to finance from here.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I'm glad to hear that, because it appears that, like you said, people are out in the hallway talking about how they're going to get together on this. So if it's going to another committee, then I'd sure hope that that you folks are able to get together with some amendments that are going to make the bill what it needs to be to bring it up to what all the players can work with, so all the stakeholders.
You know, one thing, let me just comment that we're not doing here today, but I think this year we should tackle it, and that is to give additional tax credit to people that are buying this product. I think it's like at $100 per person today, and $200 obviously for a couple. Well, we have to give more incentive, I believe, to people to buy this product, and we have to up that credit. Now, I don't know exactly what it would cost to double it or triple it, but I think I could guess what it's going to cost down the road when our baby boomers and all these other people get into these, and what, $75,000, $90,000 per person in a nursing home? And I would guess in the long run, this would save the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota a lot of money. But I just thought it makes sense to at least visit about it on your long-term health care bill. And I think we have to take a long, hard look at it. I don't have the numbers in front of me to double it, but I would think down the road, Senator, if Fishbach, I see you have.
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
It just so happens that my bill that would double that was heard this morning in tax committee. So.
Oh, coincidental. Good for you.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like to, I'll see if there's an extra spot on there for you.
I would love to be on it. I think I've... Did I introduce you?
We're just getting...
Oh, I have an amendment. No.
Oh, there you go.
We're not going to put this on. We're not going to talk about it today, but thank you for doing that. Yet. I know Senator Kasalkin names and others are...
Mr. Chair,
And Senator Goodwin are concerned about this, too. Senator Kasalkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick comment. I was going to mention that Senator Fishbach had that bill in taxes, and even after the presentation, we talked about maybe it should be $300, $400, $500 a person, kind of with the idea that what will it do to motivate more people to buy this, because at the end of the day, the state pays out dramatically less if people buy long-term care.
Absolutely.
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Lurie.
To that point, I mean, I feel this particularly keenly in the committee I chair, HHS budget. I mean, two-thirds of long-term care beds are paid for by public programs, either by the state or by the feds, Medicaid or Medicare. And that's just not sustainable going forward. And so tax credits is one approach. This is kind of another approach to try to encourage individuals to step up to the plate and have that product. So, again, if we are able to prove up the feasibility of this product, that kind of changes with people's insurance needs over time. The theory is that maybe early on, is if we can build the case for this type of product, it would serve their needs across time, and they would already be bought into that product that would transition into their long-term care needs as we moved forward. So it's another tool in the toolbox, very important conversation, particularly in the HHS budget area. So I appreciate all the comments of members here and would ask for member support.
Further discussion on this bill. Where's it go? Finance? Senate file, Senator Goodwin moves.
Yes.
Senate file 1113 to pass and
as amended.
As amended and
referred to
go to the Finance Committee on that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Sparky. Oh, no.
Senate file 1051, Senator Sparks, guaranteed asset protection waivers regulations. Welcome to the committee, Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon, and I'm happy to be here to present Senate file 1051. I do believe there's an A1 author's amendment, Mr. Chair, that members should have.
All right, without objection, to get the bill into shape for the Senator Reinhart moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, Senate file 1051 is a model act to regulate guaranteed asset protection waivers, or GAP waivers. GAP waivers are offered to consumers when they are financing the purchase of a vehicle. The waiver would protect the borrower in the case of a total loss when the debt owed is more than the value of the vehicle. The intent of this legislation is to put into place a regulatory framework for the product and to require certain consumer protections. Mr. Chair, I have with me Mr. Paul Cassidy and Matt Knowles to walk you through the bill and answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Cassidy, welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Stinson Leonard Strait, here representing Mr. Knowles and the Guaranteed Asset Protection Alliance. I'll just add a few comments to Senator Sparks and hand this off to Mr. Knowles so he can walk you through the bill and the A1 amendment. As Senator Sparks said, this bill is intended to put in place regulations and consumer protections for GAP waiver products where none currently exist in the state of Minnesota. Some financial institutions already offer this product to customers when taking out an auto loan or other motor products such as boats, RVs, etc. These products are offered currently in 47 states throughout the country. Up to this point, a handful of states have passed this model act, including Washington, Michigan, Nebraska, North Carolina, and Texas. Other states are, this is under consideration as well. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'll hand this off to Mr. Knowles, who can walk you through the highlights of the bill and also the A1 amendment. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Knowles. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. It's Matthew Knowles,
I'm with the Guaranteed Asset Protection Alliance, the Assistant Executive Director and General Counsel. The Guaranteed Asset Protection Alliance is a trade association of companies that offer these products around the country, and we're obviously here in support of Senate File 1051. This Section 1 of this legislation has to do with its applicability, or rather perhaps its inapplicability to certain organizations that are already offering it. Federal banks and state banks and credit unions already offer this product, so we've made sure to carve them out and kind of leave them alone, and they will kind of continue in status quo. Section 2 of this legislation is a definitional section. It defines the product, defines a free look period, and those types of things. Section 3 is a it has to do with commercial transactions, and it just identifies that certain sections of this legislation don't apply to commercial transactions. Section 4 sets forth general requirements applicable to this product when sold in Minnesota. It includes items like requiring retail sellers to purchase a contractual liability policy that stands behind them and helps their solvency. And it also includes a requirement that the product be optional for the consumer. Section 5 it has to do with the contractual liability policy that lenders would purchase. And it just sets forth some requirements, such as the fact that the contractual liability policy travels with the finance agreement if and when the finance agreement is sold. Section 6 is a disclosure requirements, a number of disclosures regarding the cost of the product, the terms of the product, and perhaps most important, that the product, there has to be a disclosure that the product is optional. Section 7 is related cancellation and refund provisions.
Members, any questions for the testifier? Is there anyone else here that wants to testify for it? If not, against it? Members, any more questions? All right. A good one.
I just saw that we just had handed out this Minnesota legal aid letter that has some significant concerns about this legislation, and I don't know why there wouldn't be anybody here to talk on this. It's Ron Elwood is not here. Would you like to tell us why you're objecting to this?
Mr. Elwood? State your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I simply had raised some concerns, as noted. You know, this is insurance. It doesn't matter what you call it. I mean, it's actually insurance. I know so it's called a waiver, so it apparently is theoretically outside the purview of Commerce, Department of Commerce, but I'm talking to Mr. Cassidy and the proponents, and I think the issue of whether or not Commerce does or does not have authority over the product, I think is being worked out. My understanding is your intention is that Commerce would have authority over the product. The other concern that I think is important is this, although the disclosure section does provide that there be information provided to the consumer that it's not mandatory or a condition of the purchase, I think when you get a stack of paper or a long list of disclosures that nobody will probably read, I think it would be important to make the fact that this is not obligatory much more prominent. My preference would be something separate with oral as well as written disclosure. I know extra pieces of paper cause problems for industry, but one way or the other, I think just having it buried in a big disclosure is probably insufficient to alert the consumer to the fact that this product is not mandatory nor a condition of the purchase. Those are primary concerns. I had just wanted to convey that to the author. I didn't plan to come here and derail the bill. I just wanted to suggest some improvements and some concerns.
Senator Sparks, any comments?
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, that we did receive the correspondence from Mr. Elwood, and we've been working closely with him. I think the amendment tried to address some of those discussions. Senator Metzen obviously always likes to get things worked out the best we can, and I'm confident we can get there, but obviously it'll be up to the will of this committee. But we're continuing to work, and I think we can get there.
Yeah, Ms. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, do you have another place this has to go from here, or is it done in here?
Senator Goodwin, it goes to judiciary after this.
Okay, then never mind.
And members, I
you're lucky you stepped in there.
Why don't we fix it here?
I figured when Mr. Elwood did not come forward that it was not bad. It was getting close. So, all right. With that, who wants to move this? Senator Jensen, you want to move Senate File 1051 be recommended to pass as amended and move to Judiciary. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Goodwin, do you have a constituent here?
Yes, yeah. I do.
Let's take Senator Goodwin's Senate File 624 next. Senator Goodwin, I see that you have an A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. And while that's being passed out, can I make one other amendment online, oral amendment online, 1.8?
She is Nashville.
And after the word member, put or members.
This is on the bill itself?
Yes.
Council, you want to clarify that?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we should act on the A1 first and then do the oral amendment to the bill.
Okay.
All right.
That's fine.
So the author's A1 amendment, members all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Member prevails.
And then, Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin asked that on line 8 of the bill itself, after member, insert or members.
Correct.
Everybody have that? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Oh. To your bill's amendment.
All right, thank you. And then I don't have a copy of the amendment here, but I can explain what it does. What the bill does is allow a collector collector motor vehicles to not have to insure everybody in the household for that vehicle when they are the only one that is driving it. And the amendment here makes sure that anybody that's excluded from the policy amount, the payment, is barred from making any claim under the insurance of the person that has it. So in case somebody would happen to use that car and be able to drive it from the family that isn't covered, they cannot make any claim. So that's basically what the bill does, and then I will turn it over to the man that asked.
Well, good afternoon. State your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Drew Bickford. And, basically, as Senator Goodwin stated, the problem is with these collector car policies, they're very affordable and make it much easier to keep a collector car for insurance purposes. The problem is that in other states, they allow for an exemption for people in the household that can sign a waiver and be excluded from the policy. I've been told Minnesota does not have such a policy, so everyone that lives in a household has to be included or listed under the policy. The limitations on these policies, because they are affordable and they're very limited use, if there's any kind of like speeding tickets or any kind of other kind of infractions, you're basically excluded from these policies. So even though the person that owns the vehicle and drives the vehicle can have a stellar driving record, if anybody in the household does not, your policy will be canceled. So basically, I was told in other states like Michigan, I was given the example, they have just a waiver that's able to be signed by others in the household that can exempt them from the policy, and therefore you keep your own insurance.
Senator Brown, you had a question?
No, but I have a bill up next. I think that's what he was.
Chairman, that's what we were working on down here.
Senator Dames.
You're not a mind reader.
Senator Dames, do you have a bill up or do you have a question?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Goodwin. A couple of questions for you. When you say they would not be able to make a claim, are you including bodily injury, property damage, personal injury protection, uninsured, uninsured? In other words, what you're saying is they cannot make a claim, but it's not just on the physical damage of the vehicle. It's on all the other things that go with it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Senator, that's my intention, but I see counsel nodding his head. So that is no claim at all.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Senator Goodwin, would this also require, say, for instance, that I have a collector's car, two or three of them, whatever, and I have a son or daughter that's a youthful driver, would this require then that they would be proof that they're on another policy? So we know that those folks are insured somewhere. Would you be taking that into account?
I would like to ask counsel to answer that, Senator Dames.
Senator Dames, the law currently provides anybody in your household is an insured. So if the gentleman had another car they use for general family purposes, the minor child, for example, would be covered. This gives the opportunity to not withstand that requirement of statute and exclude him on the collector car. But he's not excluded for purposes of any other car in the household.
And
Senator Dames.
They would not need to be showed on another car in the household then? Is that what?
As a matter of law, they're covered whether they're shown on a policy or not, actually.
And that's where my concern comes in. Yeah. I'd like some clarification, you know, on that language, but we'll go from there.
Any other questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not exactly clear on who would be excluded. For instance, in a collector car, if it's driven with the permission of the owner, would that person not be insured? Are we excluding everyone but the people who are in the family who are listed as, or let's say not listed as insured?
Not a good one.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I want to ask counsel about this, but my assumption is that, as it says, it's just the owner of a motor vehicle would be able to, would have to pay the insurance. So they'd be the only one covered with the collector vehicle. And otherwise, nobody else would be, I believe, but I need to refer this to counsel to make sure.
Stang?
Pretty quickly to get involved in tort concepts here of letting somebody use your automobile and so forth, then I think at that point the claim is actually being made against the owner of the car who is insured. That's kind of my sense of it. I don't know if Mr. Johnson has a better view of how this plays out practically, but I think legally there are other legal concepts that come in if the owner allowed other people to drive the car.
Senator Latz, does this need to go to judiciary?
I just heard not. Tort.
But if we got to fix it, then
no.
No, we don't have to.
Mr. Johnson, would you come up to the table? I have actually a question or two for you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I have had a chance earlier in the session to visit with Senator Goodwin, and we talked a little bit of history about the issue of named driver exclusions. And that's what this is. It's a statutory blockout of all coverages under the policy for anyone other than the owner of the car. And that you need an exclusion because, as the counsel has indicated today, under Minnesota law, insured is a defined phrase to mean everyone in the household. So it does create, as we chatted, a situation if a family member were to get in the car, actually drive it, and whatever the emergency, some circumstances, then there would not be any coverage for that family member or anybody if there were an accident. So it's just that's what the bill does. There's, again, history to named driver exclusions historically dealing with youthful family members. This issue came up a couple decades ago with the family saying, well, if I want to exclude my 16 and 17-year-old son or daughter because that has a large impact on my premiums, I won't have them drive the car. We as an industry have a problem with that because we think the practical reality is that they're likely going to be driving in the car, and so do you want coverage for them and anybody where there's an accident? So that's what the bill does. I think Senator Goodwin has put on amendments to make certain that that's what the bill does in terms of excluding any other family members from coverage if they were to be in that car.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just have another question for Senator Goodwin. Would these cars be required to have collector's plates on them?
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Dames, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dames, I have the statute here that talks about registration of collector vehicles. So that's 168.10, and that describes the different areas. It describes what a collector vehicle is in several different ways. But as far as your question goes, I haven't seen that in here that they must have special registration, but I assume that they would have to have it under this bill if they wanted to be exempt, because otherwise there would be no description for a collector vehicle.
Mr. Chairman,
I believe
the bill itself says that this vehicle has to be registered as a collector vehicle under the statute. Okay. So you have to have registration as a collector vehicle with a collector tab on the vehicle.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can, under that statute, there's five categories of plates that you can obtain: pioneer vehicles, classic cars, collector cars, street rods, and collector military vehicles. Those are the five categories under the statute that Mr. Stang just referenced. But they are, we've all probably driven, you've seen a car that has the plate collector, you're fully able to drive the car on the streets and on the roads. I don't quite understand the limitations in that statute. There are some statutory limitations under that plate, but you do have, but those are the categories of cars that would be covered by Senator Goodwin's bill.
Senator Goodwin, I'm just thinking here. I can think of a lot of cases where in my private business, somebody says that a relative is not going to drive, and they drive. And it's often a young teenager that just, they don't ask for permission. They just do it. And so this would, in this case, the way you have this written, there is no coverage.
Nope.
And, I'm just very concerned about that. But
well, Mr. Chair, that part is a protection for the insurance companies. The collector vehicle, people can have a dozen collector vehicles, and if they have a dozen of them, that means they have to pay whole family insurance on the entire collection, and that becomes awfully prohibitive and expensive. And I do believe that majority of times it is only the owner that drives them, because they show them and they enter them into different contests and so forth. So nobody else in this amendment is allowed to drive, and if they do, then they don't have coverage.
Then who pays?
And Senator Goodwin, if they don't have coverage,
yes,
then that family's out of luck. They have no coverage.
They hurt somebody else.
Just a couple extra points, too. The collector car policies, as they're written, you have to have a regular driving car. They're only for secondary use, so they're very specialized use and very limited use vehicles. So you have to have a fully registered, fully insured regular motor vehicle in the household. The other issue, too, that I was going to bring up. Let me think. I have to think for a minute.
It's okay. Copy the bill. Senator Jensen, any comments on this?
I remember now.
Oh, he's got it.
The other important thing about the collector car insurance is that it's an agreed policy agreed value policy insurance, which is very important compared to like a regular insurance policy, which is the primary problem that I had with keeping a collector car and not being able to insure it through collector car insurance because of my girlfriend. It's a stated value and agreed value, so whatever you agree with the insurance company the value of the car is, that's the check that you will get if something happens, if it goes on fire, if it's stolen, versus a regular policy, which will only cover an equal value, what they deem is an equal value, which can be considerably lower than the actual value of your car. So,
okay. Members, any more questions? Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm still a little bit fuzzy about the lack of coverage. So does that mean that if someone does take your automobile, that there is no liability coverage on that car?
That's correct.
So the owner of the car is the one that, if that car is used in does some damage, then it would be the owner that this would fall onto.
Correct. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, they understand that. I mean, when they don't pay for insurance for the rest of the family, they understand that if somebody stole the vehicle and even drove it, they wouldn't be covered. So that would be then their responsibility, and that would be the penalty for not having other additional coverage.
Senator Brown, quickly. And we're
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we should amend this so that they have a lawyer present before they choose to do this.
Lance likes that.
Why don't we send it to judicial?
Why don't we just pass an amendment that every person in Minnesota must have a lawyer on retainer?
That's what the postcards are.
And Mr. Chair, I am sure that Senator Lance will have another amendment to name who those lawyers have to be.
Senator Goodwin, there are some concerns here, but what are your wishes?
My wishes would be to pass the bill.
All right. Senator Goodwin moves that we pass the Senate File 624 as amended and be referred to the...
782.
I'm sorry. 782?
No. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm,
624.
Oh, that's your bill, Vicki.
As amended.
I guess I'll pass my own.
You did a lot quicker than I did.
So Senate 624 as amended and referred to the or passed to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
I haven't asked for a division.
All those that voted in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? Motion does not prevail. All right, next on the list is Senate File 957, Senator Jensen, no-fault automobile insurance reform task force.
I thought it was Brownie.
Oh,
Brownie.
Oh, she has to go to a certain number. I guess not.
I tried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Coming over to you, Jess. Tell Matt some thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Senate File 957 establishes a no-fault automobile insurance reform task force, and I do have an amendment, but I don't know the number of the amendment if the council can help me. Council.
I'm sorry, Senator Jensen.
What this amendment does is it adds the ambulatory surgery to the group. We had a lot of conversation earlier today in this committee about no fault, and there are reforms that need to happen within that system, and I don't think we're going to come to any good conclusion until we take a longer look at the issues that fall under reform. So hopefully you're in favor of this, and we can pass this on.
Yep. Senator Jensen moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. No. Motion prevails.
So I would move that 957 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the State and Local Government Committee.
That is the correct motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Oh, hang on. We didn't quite get there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Abler.
I signed up to testify, so I won't be long.
I'm sorry. I missed you. Go
it's
ahead.
Okay. I'm hurt, but, Mr. Chair, I will just somehow cope. But thanks. actually, this is my first full committee testimony. I had to practice at the work group as my this is my testimony, but I, Mr. Chair, I'm speaking, Jim Abler, representing Summa MRI, and also here in my own right as a 36-year chiropractor and health provider. Also, you and I were the joint authors of the first successful task force working group, and a product came out of that. So I wanted to just testify briefly about that. Minnesota is fortunate to be one of 9 or 10 states that still has no fault, and I hope we can remain that way because it's really important for injured parties to have access to adequate care to get well. As I mentioned in the working group, that the primary goal of no-fault insurance is to restore loss, either mechanical loss like your car or somebody's house that gets run into, or the injured party so they can become recovered and resume their work. And just to be brief, the issue of all the things we attempt to go to reform is based upon outliers and people who don't conform to the normal standard of operating behaviors. Providers come and complain about insurance companies. They're complaining about an outlier adjuster or an outlier company which is not part of the main body of behaviors. Insurance companies come complain about providers. They're complaining about the outliers who are out of the normal body of the majority of providers of any particular profession. And I think if we recognize that, you understand quite a bit of the dialogue that goes on. Today's discussion you've had before has been a really good example about how good people disagree on how to best handle this. But at the end of the day, I think it would be useful for both providers and insurance companies and attorneys, et cetera, to recognize that in their ranks they have people who are doing amazing quality work on behalf of the clients, patients, attorney clients, and doing just what's right for them. But if we all acknowledge that there's parts of our professions, our industry, of our personnel who are frankly wrong, then we can agree to actually remedy this without causing harm to those who are doing the work. In brief, Mr. Chair, if you pile too hard on providers across the board, the fraudsters, Mr. Chair, if there's fraudsters, does that make me a lobster then? I'm a lobbyist, anyway. Just thinking about that. But you want to go after the ones who are misbehaving. There are some who have very small parts of their practice or small utilizations. If you pile too hard on them, they just give it up. And those injured clients wind up going where the marketing is, which is into the high users. You're actually going to increase costs by pounding on those who are low. So you want to beware, and I think that the position I'm in with my experience and my client, who's already been interested in going after fraud on the part of some different providers, can be useful in this dialogue. And so, but I think all parties need to recognize that there are some offenders in their ranks. If we can focus on those and how to get rid of that, we don't have to call, there'll be a very successful task force. And I don't know who all is on the task force at this point, Mr. Chair, but it doesn't matter who much the voting people are, but if all can be heard as the process goes forward, and it's going to be truly effort to solve it, then people will testify. But you know as well as I do that some people don't want to come testify for fear of coming to harm or losing some advantage. But if the gain is you have a stable, nice, no-fault system that serves the clients at the end, that's what we all want. And so I may be a naive optimist, Mr. Chair, but I think it can happen. We found it to be true last year. And so I urge you to pass the bill, and I hope that there can be a successful interim time. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well said, Mr. Abler. Anybody else want to comment on this bill? I'm sorry that I was going to bring that to a close. All right. Senator Jensen moves Senate File 957 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the state and local government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Senator Metzen, do you want to take your bill, or what is your pleasure?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Senate File 1038. Insurance fraud prevention, accounting, funding modifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, I believe, passed unanimously last year in this committee. It deals with the auto theft prevention program that was created in 1996 and is overseen by the Department of Commerce Fraud Bureau. What happened, and we assess a surcharge on a 50 cents per customers on auto insurance coverage But what happened in 2004, they transferred half the proceeds to the general fund.
Okay, okay.
And when the insurance industry agreed to the 50-cent surtax, I mean, they obviously thought, and I did too at that time, that the money would be used to fight fraud. And what this bill attempts to do is just get the money back to where we believe it belongs. And you can see the wonderful authors we have here. Senator Kasalka is the second author, very strong. But anyway, this just simply gets the money back to where most of us believe it belongs. And that's why the 50-cent surtax was put on, to fight fraud, and that's where exactly the money belongs. And I believe, Mr. Johnson, it's $1.2 million. Yeah, or so,
1.3
that was raided, and I call it raided, from the fund in 2004. We want the money back to where I believe and others believe that it belongs to work on fraud.
And Senator Metzen, for the record, both sides have raided that fund over the years. So, but you have a technical A1 amendment that Mr. Stang drafted,
yes,
author's
I do.
Amendment.
So move it.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Did both sides steal this money over the years?
Okay. They have.
Well, we're going to correct that, hopefully.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just to support Senator Metzen's effort, this committee unanimously passed it. There is a commitment, just so the committee members know, across the board within. There's a lot of groups that support this bill and the efforts that aren't here today. The Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, Commerce Commissioner Mike Rothman. I'm meeting with the two of them in a couple of days to continue the discussions on this bill and the specifics that we'll be working with Chairman Metzen and the House leaderships to get this done in 2015. So thank you, committee members.
Members, we have one other bill after this, so if there's no other questions, we're going to move this to finance.
Thank you. That's fine.
Senator Metzen moves Senate File 1038 as amended to be passed and sent to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Motion very much.
Last bill is Senate 1290, Brown, federal do not call rule violations, also state law violation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before us, I have Senate File number 1290, and the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission do already have do not call rules in place. This bill would adopt them as state policy and give the Attorney General's office more tools in their toolbox to go after telemarketers or anybody who's calling you once you've placed your phone number upon the do not call list. I've been doing many expos this year, and I've had many seniors, which is what prompted me to do this bill, come up to me and say they're tired of all these people calling them. They'll ask them to identify themselves, and they get hung up on. They ask for their phone number to be removed from the list, and they just get hung up on. This is illegal, and this gives the Attorney General's office more tools to go after these people.
Senator Brown, do you have anybody to testify for?
I do not.
Is there any folks
there's
in the audience?
There's absolutely no opposition to this bill.
Look at this folder.
I wish Senator Latz was here. I think we could have an amendment to
Well, judiciary
attorneys.
Did ask.
No!
Judiciary did request a hearing for this.
That's where it's going. So, if there's no more questions, then Senator Brown moves Senate File 1290 be passed and re-referred to judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we meet again on Wednesday, and Senator Metzen should be back in charge. So we have adjourned.
We, if you let me. Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe we're done.
Great job. Yeah.